There's so much hatred that we have taken in unconsciously without even knowing it, that we are still trying to unpack. And at the core of all of it is a sense and a desire to celebrate a sense of liberation for each of us as beauty, as women, as men, and wherever you are, a sense of freedom in how you inhabit your skin.
We are witnessing America as a failed social experiment.
How do we tell this story in a way that builds the kind of emotional momentum that colorblind ideology builds?
So many young brothers and sisters of the younger generation find themselves so far removed from the best of their past.
What are we going to make out of the nothing we've been given? How do you envision possibility?
Hey everyone, thank you so much for joining us on The Tightrope, where we engage in a love and justice infused dialogue, and we try desperately to keep our balance on tough issues. I'm Tricia Rose, and I'm here with my dear friend and brilliant colleague, Dr. Cornel West. But even more amazing is that today we have an amazing and dear friend and a brilliant actress, comedian, a businesswoman, leader in the community, and many, many, many other amazing things we're going to talk about right now. And that is Miss Amazing Tracy Ellis Ross. Tracy, yay. Welcome to The Tightrope.
What a treat. I mean, this is a treat. I'm trying to turn Do Not Disturb on my computer. Wait, I just realized I don't have that on. Let's do that now.
Yeah, Do Not Disturb us, everybody.
Do Not Disturb. We are about to have a loving and justice-filled conversation. I want no interruptions.
See, you already made the intro like 10 times better. Okay. Oh my goodness. So
I'm telling you, we're just so blessed with exemplar of an artistic nobility. Because when you're talking about the Ross family, you talk about Tracy and you talk about Diane, you're talking about Robert, all of them together. A force for good and the connection of their mind and hearts and souls, and they have enriched our lives in ways we don't have a language for.
I was just going to say thank you for so much for having me. Tricia and I are dear friends, and Dr. West, you are one of the beacons in all of our lives, but you have taught me so much about language and the use of language and the ability to let language be a tool. In a way that I am still a student of and so grateful for people like both of you that take not only your knowledge, experiential knowledge, book knowledge, but heart-based knowledge and intertwine that in a way that allows us to create frames in our life that otherwise things and information kind of seeps through. And I'm just so grateful. And so I'm happy to be in dialogue with you. I feel like I'm in dialogue with you even when I'm not on your podcast, but that's my problem.
No, your spirit is with us all the time and we welcome you.
All the time. Absolutely. I really wish that, you know, I could just tap into like, what is Tracy thinking about this right now? Because you always have, I know, you have to breathe before you even say
breath.
It.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's really true. I mean, you know, hearing each other's voices and developing a collective vocabulary, that's an important part of creating an alternative consciousness to the madness that we're facing. And, you know, Cornel is, I mean, I repeat lectures of his over and over again. I'm just like, okay, I got to listen to this again because I'm about to act a fool. So let me just check in with the tradition. About to say the wrong thing. But I want to start we're going to probably get bigger and deeper into much headier issues, but I want to start with just a couple of things about your last few years and what you've been doing professionally. And then, you know, we'll go all over the place, but I want to start with when I invited you to Brown. In 2014, and
was
we
it
did
already
an interview
six
together.
Years ago. Wow.
I know it flies by. And in fact, Black-ish had not yet launched.
Wow.
It was May and you were launching in September.
Wow.
And you were describing what Black-ish was about and all of the fracas about Black-ish, people saying it wasn't legit and it was sort of anti-Black to be calling it Black-ish. And, you know, you were trying to describe the sitcom and what it was up to. And I'm wondering if you can reflect on that moment now, given the extraordinary success of the sitcom, the fact that it seems to have captured a way of thinking about a Black middle class, but Black conscious space, and all of the creative interventions you've made around US history, around slavery, and the sort of content of the show itself. I mean, it must feel like a very different moment than now, yes?
Wow, yeah, it does. Like I think of the, first of all, when you're launching out into something new, it always feels trepidatious. And particularly, you know, our show was holding a space of something that felt on the edge with people's reaction to the name and all of that. And I felt so proud of a show that was following a couple that was in love and a family that was dealing with all the things that all of us are dealing with in life. Race, mm-hmm. identity, culture. How do you let your children start from your shoulders without losing your own identity and what's important to you? What are you passing on to your children? And I thought this was a really important dialogue to be having, and particularly through the lens of a family that was thriving and not just surviving in the world, which is so often how we're portrayed as people of color in entertainment. And that's changing. But so the landscape of the world, though, was so different. The Obamas were in office. I love that we say the Obamas and not Obama. The Obamas were in office, which I think is part of what ushered in the ability to have the Johnsons on Black-ish be an American family. And then you see where we are now and sort of what has progressed and how quickly so much of democracy can hang by its thread and how fragile all of that is. But I mean, it changed my career.
Huge.
It also, I can say this in this conversation, but you know, I had a lot of hesitancy personally, which I know, Tricia, you and I have spoken about. But, you know, I went from what was considered a Black sitcom, because, you know, the entertainment industry is still so segregated. We're still working on that. But you have Black lead actors and it's called a Black sitcom. And then it moves into a different stratosphere of what is expected from it. And then I moved to ABC and I'm on a show called Black-ish. And I'm like, okay, now. All right.
Yeah. You thought you broke out of you didn't break out of anything.
Nah. But you know, all these years later, like I am a lead actress on two of the longest running Black sitcoms that have existed that have been part of creating that landscape, you know. So I don't know if I answered your question.
Yeah. No, you did. You did. Oh, for sure.
But I think a lot of it has to do with your sheer artistry.
Mm-hmm.
That jazz, like that you can move in a flexible protean way, different contexts, different roles. I mean, you singing in high note, Love Myself, sounding so good.
Right.
At the same, she can do comedy when she wants to. She can do drama and bring tears to your eyes. She can sing with her mama on the stage there in Las Vegas. Lady sings the blues and still hit those beautiful notes with or without the instruments. It's the artistry. Tell us something about what goes into the making of your artistry.
You know, it's so interesting. You were talking about, I'm not sure what the word protean, I think it was that moves in and out, but it's all the same to me. It's all telling the truth.
Mm.
It's all about connecting to the honesty of it, that part of me known as, and it was funny because, you know, when the singing happened for High Note, that was a childhood dream that I've had for so long that I kind of tucked away. And I think some of it was an unconscious tucking away and some of it was a conscious, like I knew how I could be taken down in comparison. And it felt terrifying that I could actually be dismantled of sorts, you know? Why would I try to do something like that in comparison? And what I discovered, which was mind-boggling to me, is at 47, which is what I am now, about to turn 48, to dive into something so new and so scary, I felt like I didn't know what, like, how do I do this? I don't know how to do this. Like, it just felt so daunting. And, you know, I think the older you get, you know how far you can fall.
You know too much. You know too much.
Like when you're a kid, like you can learn how to ski and do all that stuff. Cause like also you're smaller. There's not as much like place to fall. So, but what I discovered that it really was just another version of the same thing that I do with all aspects, even with the hair products. I try to tell the truth. I really like to be aware of the context, both the small context of what I'm doing and the historical context. Like, you know, on Black-ish for me, a lot of the choices that I make, I want to make sure that they are painting a full enough picture of who this character is, that she's not in context just to her husband, in context of her kids, in context of, so that she really is a part of the whole. And that even if everything that I do on camera doesn't tell you the whole, you can tell there was a life when I wasn't on camera. Mm. And with the singing, I realized that I had discovered my voice long before I started singing. And that it was the same voice that I got to use for the singing, and that it was all about letting the vibration hit up against everything that I am. And that that was my version of soul, that I, there was no way I was going to sound like Aretha Franklin, like Diana Ross, like Jennifer Hudson, but that what I could do that no one else could do was sound like Tracy Ellis Ross and get out of my own way.
But you sounded good.
Yeah, sounded, I know.
But you look so much at home behind that microphone. You really
I think it's because I'm at home in my skin, though.
Ah, now see, that makes a difference. But you also have your mother, 1972, should have won an Oscar, Lady Saints of Blues. Yeah,
sure,
so even as an actor, you already had a high standard. So it's a high artistic standard. But you have been able to meet that standard, though, Sister Tracy.
I guess, I don't know. It's hard. That's hard to take in, Dr. West. I'm just going to say. That is hard to take in. I will let that gently roll off me and maybe I'll hold it later.
Yeah, exactly. I know he does that. He does that to all of us. We're always just like, okay.
Just telling the truth.
Okay. All right. That's always true too. That's always true too. But, you know, as you said, you're doing it with acting, you know, with you know, comedic work. But I want to talk a little bit about the traditions and the big picture that you were just referring to, but especially how that shapes your investment in beauty. You know, there's a lot of, you know, assumption that beauty is trivial and, you know, shallow. And some days it is kind of shallow on the internet. You know, I can get lost in, you know, some dumbness.
Yeah.
But it's also something very politically significant, particularly for Black women. And you have figured out over the course of, I'd say, at least 10 years on YouTube and on your Instagram and everything else, how to make it both fun and still meaningful, right? Where it's attached to a certain kind of self-love and self-appreciation for how you come naturally, right? I mean, for our fans who are a bit younger, they may not be aware of how complicated it was to wear your hair the way it actually comes out of your head as a Black woman, regardless of how straight or whatever kind of curls you happen to have. It was literally in alien practice. And so when you put your work in the context of, say, the Black is Beautiful movement, and then, you know, the expansion of natural hair care, I think you've played this really important role. I just wondered if you could talk a little bit more about, you know, how you came to that, and, you know, whether or not you had a plan, or was it just you, Tracy, being Tracy? You know, how did that come together?
Well, it started as my own personal journey and my own conflict with my sense of appearance and how it didn't match up to what I was seeing. I'm sure it matched up to my family. You know, I was supported in how my hair grew out of my head by my mom and my cousins and siblings. We all had natural hair and my mom wore natural texture and all of that. But, you know, you don't care if your mom's Diana Ross or whoever. When you're a teenager, you don't want to look like your mother. I mean, you want to look like what the
even when she's Diana Ross?
No, you don't care. You're just like, oh, please, get out of here. Like, you, oh, but Tracy, you look beautiful. Okay, Mom. Yep. You know, like, it doesn't help. You're looking at magazines. You're looking at music. You're looking at television. television and you're looking to see people that look like you, that support you in a sense of feeling, you know, at that time for me, it was all about what boys were going to think I was cute or whatever that was. And that, you know, my age, I was born in 72. So I was a teenager in the 80s. And so 80s, 90s, and it was all bouncing and behaving, easy, breezy, beautiful. My hair didn't move in the breeze. Like, I don't know what they were asking.
It just got tangled in the breeze. That's all that happened.
I mean, it didn't work. So for me, it started as a personal journey and realizing that there weren't products and there weren't things, there weren't images that were allowing me to be mirrored back to myself. And it was hard to hold my own sense of self-love without seeing enough of it. It wasn't yes, it's possible. Of course it is. But it does help when you get those images mirrored back to you on the wallpaper of your experience, you know, what you're sort of walking by on a regular basis. As I started to embrace my own hair, like I could probably chronicle my journey of self-acceptance through my journey with my hair. As I started to meet my hair, greet my hair, accept my hair, and on some really strange days, love my hair, I started to understand who I was and also connect myself to a larger legacy of what right. my hair was a part of, right. you know, and now I know, like, you know, it during slavery, like maps were braided into hair. There's, you know, messages of love, the connection between a mother and a daughter and being mm. able to do those, the beautiful artistry that happens with our hair. And so by the time I made it onto Girlfriends, I had already embraced my natural texture. I was one of the only people, not in life, on television. Newscasters weren't wearing their hair naturally, but you could see there was Cree Summer on Different World. There was Lisa Nicole Carson, Radon Chong. There were like five people that I could point to. And by the time I left Girlfriends, I was like, there are no products. And so I wrote my first right. hair care brand pitch. And it was really, there were two things that started to develop as I wanted to make these brands and what has now become the mission of the company. One, to create effective products that actually worked for our hair to wear it naturally so that it could be, they didn't exist. Exactly. There were products that would hydrate your hair to the point that we could blow it straight and put so much heat on it, like right. slick it down, oil it, like do all these different things, but not if you wanted to wear your hair naturally. And the other part is to actually be an active space where we were celebrating Black beauty at our core. And that to me is the paradigm shift, because so much of the industry was mirroring back a version of us that you had to manipulate in order to get, as right. if who you are authentically is not beautiful. And
it's,
I just
not good enough. I just want to say very quickly to our audience that it's not only this amazing personal journey and investment that Tracy's talking about that, you know, that she's overcoming, but there's tremendous discrimination against women in the workplace and in school, and prisons and everywhere, right? Based on their hair, and that they can literally be fired for being messy, for being out of line. And this whole passing of the Crown Act has been an effort to really identify the central role of Black women's hair. And in this case, probably all Black hair, because you go to the end of NBA or the NFL, brother's got a wild set of hairstyles going on too.
But it's also, there's been so many cases, Trisha, of that young boy that wasn't allowed to compete as a wrestler.
And they cut his dreads.
There's so many, you know, and the truth is that the celebration of Blackness is political. It in the face of racism, it is. And so the Crown Act, in essence, is about protecting who we authentically are. It's not just about our hair. And so you, in the beginning, right. the question that you asked about the politics of it, there's so much hatred that we have taken in unconsciously without even knowing it, that we are still trying to unpack. And at the core of all of it is a sense and a desire to celebrate a sense of liberation for us, for each of us, as beauty, as women, as men, and wherever you are, a sense of freedom in how you inhabit your skin.
Right, for sure.
Absolutely.
Definitely. Yeah.
Well, this is deep stuff, though. I mean, if beauty itself is a fundamental human response to being terrorized and traumatized, that beauty itself then becomes not just a weapon, but it becomes a condition in which we live to be able to be creative human beings and agents responding to terror and trauma just long enough to be able to feel a sense of being at home and to spread it, to send it out the way Astrid and Simpson say. Astrid and Simpson say, just send it, just keep sending out that hope and that love. But the beautiful thing about it is that it means that whiteness itself is not the point of reference. It may be a response to whiteness, but it's not the point of reference.
Yep.
It's from a tradition that itself has had to respond to terror and trauma. And then with all of that style, that's what all of that style in the hair. And it's the way you walk, the way you talk, it's your hair, it's your connection, it's your love, it's your grin, it's your touch, it's your smile, it's your hug. You see, that's a way of being, which is love-centered, which is Black to the core at its best. Now, we got Black thugs and gangsters, too. But, I mean, at its best in that way, you see.
I wrote down, I'm so big on taking notes, but I wrote a sense of home. And that is it, the sense of home in your own skin, especially, home in your own body when we know the violence and brutality that has been inflicted on our bodies and what that means. And as you were talking, Dr. West, I kept thinking of Thelma Golden of the Studio Museum of Harlem. She took me to Carrie James Marshall's show here in LA, and I got to walk it with her. And if to walk through an art show with somebody who knows that much is just
Sister Thelma. We love Sister Thelma.
Oh my God. I mean, this is right at the highest level. She is incredible. And so I just was in awe, but she explained a story which I am so not going to do justice to, but has just stuck with me forever, which is that Carrie James Marshall, in the way that he, when you are taught color as an artist, they teach you to mix everything with white paint. That's how you create color. And so in all of the skin and color that he works with, he mixes with black paint. And it just gives me chills just thinking of just that gentle shift of context of, it's like the idea of Black futurism, that it's that our identity doesn't have to be designed in relationship to trying to get out of the trauma and out of that supremacy and that all of that. But instead, it's like if you were to imagine oneself, one's blackness, one's beauty, one's sense of home from that space, what do you become? What liberation is available to you? Right. And it also reminds me, you know, this gender movement that is happening right now, I'm so grateful for. When it first happened, I thought, oh, these constraints of man and woman and female and like the, you know, blue and pink and this whole thing that I was raised with. I took a minute there. I was like, would I be something different if I had known there were other choices? And I still land in the same place. But what would have been different is I would have been able to dream outside of those lines for what I wanted from my life that was not just available for a woman, was available when you grow, you know, and I think the same around race. So I just, it's an interesting thing to ponder.
But that's what I feel though when I hear your inimitable mother singing with Lionel, Endless Love. That the whiteness is not a reference for that song. They're inviting us to inhabit a space of Black humanity that is so embracing and so welcoming and so soothing in the midst of all the terror and trauma that we're wrestling with, which is a Black musical tradition that we talk about all the time, you see. But to be able to transfer that on the canvas, or in a poem, or in a novel, in an essay, because music has its own dynamic that's a little different than the words on the page, you see.
Yeah, I think that's actually one of my mother's gifts among many. But my mother has a capacity and a connection to love that I have never experienced anywhere else. It is an open channel that, and you use that expression, inhabit a space. And even as I look at my mom and sort of her articulation of sensuality and sexuality as a Black woman, but it's always, this is me, not look at me, which is very different. And it reminds me the same thing of that sort of pure channel of love that isn't a response to something.
Yeah, yeah. You know, both of you are saying something that's so important, because neither the endless love or any or black hair and traditions, they're all about, you know, everybody already knows the basis of the trauma that we've gone through, right? So the expression of it doesn't need to remind itself, right? So it sort of takes that as a given, but then sort of sets about the business of transcending it and giving people a way of managing it by imagining something else. So, I mean, I think Black futurism has actually been going on certainly since we landed on the shores of the West, right? Because that's in true. That sense, if you can imagine yourself surviving this, and you can imagine yourself communicating with other people in hair care, in quilts, in song, in dance, in drum, and actually make it happen. I mean, that's Black futurism, if you ask me.
Absolutely.
And another big piece that relates to what you do, Tracy, is the use of comedy, the use of laughter, the use of the absurdity. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've been giving a lecture in class and then I just burst out laughing. I mean, it's so crazy what I'm actually saying. I'll be like, you know, y'all, I'm not making this up. I know you're going to think I'm making this up. And it's so crazy. We need to laugh for a minute. And they don't get it. They're like, this is not funny. I'm like, oh yeah, it happens often enough. You better start to get to laughing. Because what you gonna do, right?
Yeah, it'll take you down if you don't.
Exactly. So comedy has been so important to you, and you are just truly an incredibly funny person. I mean, talking to you is just a constant laugh festival. And then, you know, all the work you were doing prior to Black-ish, those amazing women's characters that are just, I'll have to tell them about this in a minute, but I'll let her answer the first question. But just how have you gotten to this comedy? You know, where does it come from? Were you always just a funny kid, or was it that you used it to manage situations that were as absurd as all we know is going on? Or how did you get to that?
It's so interesting. But how did I get to it? You know, my personality, my silliness came out of a sense of shyness. Like, it was a way that I kept people at a distance. You can be just as invisible in a big personality as you can being a fly on the wall, you know? And so for me, it was sort of this. And also, for some reason, I felt it was my job to like enter a room, take the temperature, and then turn it sunny. So I was like, where we at? Is it raining? Is it cloudy? How you doing? Let's get you going. You know, I love making people feel. I was always the one. I mean, I'm a big feeler. I'm very dramatic. I mean, I just like, I'm one of those people that like, when I feel a feeling, you know, when you get out of the shower and the mirror is all foggy and you're like, but like, imagine you get out of the shower, you look at the mirror and you're like, the mirror broke. Like it broke. Like the shower has joined the mirror. Oh my God. Like that's what it's like when I have a feeling. I'm like, my feeling has taken over all the windows. And it's not until like slowly it opens up like, oh, it was just a feeling. It was just a feeling. It's fine. So I feel deeply. It's one of the aces in my deck, but I've also had to learn how to manage it as an adult, how to navigate and know that it's not the truth of everything. It's not a fact. It's just the truth of the moment. And I can listen to my feelings. And so I think because I'm dramatic and feel things so deeply, comedy kind of comes into it, because if the stakes are always that high, you got to be able to laugh at yourself or you're going to go crazy.
Yeah, but you're kind of underselling your comedic talents.
Really?
Because, yeah. Yeah. I mean, everything you said, I think is true. I would concur, okay. But that's not all it is, because you invent scenarios and people and scenes that are just fundamentally hysterical, and they're not related to a feeling you're having immediately right before. Do you know what I mean? I mean,
okay.
So Cornell, what you may not know is where we originally met was at a conference of, you know, women leaders in media and education and other places, and Tracy was going to be doing a performance of some characters that she had written. And I'm going to let her describe it in greater detail, but basically I was like a mock interviewer of a mock character. And
was that the first time we met in person, Tricia?
Yeah.
Oh wow, okay.
Yeah, we met in person when that journalist was grilling you illegally, and I got all pissed and came over. I didn't even know you. I was like, no, this is not going to happen, you know, because other people were trying to be, you know, media sensitive. I'm like, I'm not media sensitive. That's why I became an academic. Move out the way. Leave her alone. You're not supposed to talk to her. But remember that?
I do.
Yeah. So this tell Cornell and everyone else about Madame
Hiver.
Hiver, winter in French, right? Yeah. I had to get my French together. Yeah, so, Madame Hiver.
So I, in the space between, growing up, I always tell stories, and unbeknownst to me, I would tell them and sort of inhabit all of these different voices and characters. And so I didn't even realize I was doing it. A friend was like, you should work on a one woman show. And I was like, sure. What's a one woman show? And I started developing these characters. And then in the space between girlfriends and nothing, when it got kind of empty in there, I had a chance to dive into these characters. And part of what I realized was I'm not afraid of my shadow qualities. And I think also I have a sense of trust and freedom in my body. And that is a lot of where my comedy comes from, Tricia, I use my body in really silly ways and I'm not self-conscious. So I'm not afraid of what I look like. I'm actually more interested in what it feels like. Mm. And I think that's part of how I guide myself through my work, is that it's not really about creating something that I want you to see a certain way, but that I want you to feel a certain way. Mm-hmm. And when I tell stories, I mean, you can tell, like I talk with my hands, I move, I always lean in. Like I have a line on my stomach right here because I always bend like this because I'm always leaning in. Mm. And some like meditation teacher or something, she was like, you can trust. I was like, trust what? she was like, you can sit back into it. I was like, But so these characters, so Madame Hiver, she is, you're a dear. She lives within. She's sort of this over the top. She's an actress, but she's not really. She drinks a lot. You're a dear. Everything's got a smile. And, she's had a career that really didn't go anywhere. And so I started playing around. I have Calabi Champignon, she's a style architect. She doesn't like to be a stylist because it's so stupid. These people that do this now, it's so dumb. But so I have all these different characters that really in my thinking is they are birthed out of parts of me that perhaps are not dignified expressions of things that I feel, but they must come out of me. I imagine that writers maybe express them through what they write. Actors get to do it through characters that other people have written, but I have gotten to, I seem to have the joy and the freedom to just kind of go there. Sometimes a character comes out of the telling of a story. Sometimes it's something that I've heard and I'm imitating. Sometimes it's sort of a way that I am expressing something that just my regular voice seems silly. Like it just doesn't do it justice to what I'm trying to say. My mother says that I'm always doing different characters, and sometimes I'll be on the phone with her. I remember what we went through this phase. She like started talking in an accent. I was like, what are you doing? And she said, I'm just copying you. I was like, I'm not talking in an accent. She said, yeah, you are. And I was like, oh, I didn't even realize. She was like, yeah, I just started talking like you. She was like, I was talking like you were talking. And I was like, oh. I don't even know that I'm doing it. But you know, I am such a heart and feet based person. Like it's like, I'm connected to sort of what I'm feeling and what's happening. Mm. Which is why, honestly, right now, I feel like I had this conversation with you, Tricia, but as the pandemic and then with George Floyd's murder and the uprisings that were occurring, I couldn't feel my feet for a long time. Mm. I just felt like I literally, when I would get quiet in meditation or whatever, I was like, I can't feel my feet. Mm. And I realized it was because the foundation is shifting beneath us. Mm. And it was appropriate to not be able to feel my feet. It would have been some sort of fantasy if I was imagining that I was actually grounded to something. And then kind of the metabolizing of information. And I think that's where the characters come in often for me. It's sort of like, how do I make sense of a lot of non-make sensible stuff? Mm. And where do I put it? And sometimes words are not quite the way, but the formulation of a person is.
Right. Yeah.
But you know, there's this underside of the comic, though, that you all tell me what you think. Because when I think of, the great comic writers from Aristophanes to Chekhov or Ishmael Reed or the great comic performers, Moms Mabley and Richard Pryor, that they have this tremendous courage to be vulnerable. They have this oversensitivity to other people's pain. And therefore, they choose to be wounded healers and bruised uplifters to others. And I think people see that in you, Sister Tracy. I mean, it's the first time we get a chance to meet and so forth. But I mean, your spirit is just flowing. The joy is just contagious. And it's as real as a heart attack in terms of being so concrete. And you say to yourself, "Ooh, now this is a sister who has just courage to be vincible and vulnerable, to lay herself in a for real way with others and then be sensitive to other people, because the world that we live in is so cold and cruel. It's always been cold and cruel. You know what I mean? So to have that kind of sensitivity is like an orange without a peel. You know, you just feel everything, and you have to transfigure it and transmute it into some kind of joy so that others can touch it and feel better, given the darkness and grimness that they're wrestling with. That's a powerful thing.
Man, I'd see
at work in Sister Tracy's life. I mean, that put a smile on your mama and your daddy's face in terms of how you wrestle with that. You know what I mean?
I'm a little speechless for a moment. So Trisha,
let me help you out. Well, this happens every week with Cornell with me. I'm just waiting to be rendered speechless. But what he's really right about, even in terms of not only your creative work, but my experience of you as a human being on the face to face, is that what you're saying is silliness is vulnerability. Right. It is. There really is a givingness to that. It's saying when you walk into a room, you want to take the temperature and you don't want people to feel this pain. You want them to tap into this tab and see if they can get a piece of it, which will then make you happy. Your happiness comes from seeing people be light. And so, you know, when you talk about how important joy is for Black people, it's not a philosophical matter. It's a practice on the ground for you. It's called, I got to spread joy because there's too much pain.
And you know what, Trisha, first of all, so both of you, again, I'll say what I said in the beginning, and I'm just so grateful that people like you, like I know the limits of my knowledge, and I'm so grateful to have a life that keeps letting me bump up against and play with and talk to people who have language that I don't have. And so I'm an orange without a peel. I'm like, I'm just going to take that for a week and let that metabolize.
Yep.
But you know, one of the things I said I was dramatic and I feel things big. I realized about 10 or 15 years ago that I have a gift at moving feelings. I can take real big feelings and move them, which is a burden at times. And I've had to learn how to be with it, but I can take them and move them through because I've had to learn how to not take them personally. Right. So they're that like not put a meaning on them, that they mean something about me. But I think that maybe that plays into and kind of makes sense for what you're saying, how you're mirroring back what I have shared, that there's a way that I am willing to, or that God gave me as like a little bit of the thing that is that I can move them. I can hold big ones, because as you know, Trisha, like they go deep for me, and I chomp on things real deep, but I'm also not afraid to sit. One thing I can say is I'm not afraid to sit with people in their vulnerability either.
No, you're really not. It's a beautiful thing.
That's a beautiful thing.
Right.
In our friendship thing. And in places, like to be able to say, like, I hear you and I see you in that pain, and thank you. What an honor to have that shared with me. Like, and I hold that with the honor that it deserves.
Yeah, it doesn't, because you know what to do with it. It neither becomes something you push away nor something that you take in and get consumed with. That balance is an incredible gift. It's an incredible gift for sure.
Well,
I know you have to go in a minute, but I wanted to make sure you have this idea that I want to make sure people hear about, and then I know we have to let you go. But you talk about rest as resistance.
Yeah.
And first of all, that's a woman after my heart, because anybody who says I can resist while I'm taking me a nap is a friend of mine. I'll be like, yo, I'm resisting. So anyway, that's just my silly take. But But share what you mean. I couldn't agree with you more, but I just want people to think about this because we always think action, resistance, fighting, protesting, well,
and
all
we
really
think
important.
Hustle. We think hustle. We think, you know, we think pack it all in, see how much you can get done. Okay, there's like a couple pieces to that. I think the idea of that came from Audre Lorde. And I can't think of the quote right now. I'm not good at that, but it came from that and a pondering about that. Things that she says around how we, it's not self-indulgence. It's how we care for ourselves is part of that, the revolution and resistance. I think of joy, you know, I had heard for so many years, like joy is revolutionary. And I was like, sure. I don't get it. Joy, Black joy is revolutionary. I'm like, sure. And then during this last wave that has been so public in the racial reckoning, because obviously this is not, it's a constant. I really understood that for the first time on a really visceral level. And same thing with rest and joy and celebration. Like if you don't take those moments to fill the well and to care for yourself, first of all, the care of self as a Black person in this country is a revolution and is resistance. I'm sorry.
Absolutely.
You don't have to be out on the front of the lines to be partaking in this. Me being alive is that. Me being alive fully, freely, all of that, that is resistance. And particularly the self-care and the ability to rest your heart, to rest your soul, to rest your body, to give your body the honor that it deserves, to listen to your body, which in my opinion is the most, the main place I go for wisdom is what is my body telling me. The other thing I've discovered as an adult is that I call it the wander, ponder, be. I cannot think of things and let my imagination run. In this world that we have with social media and all, I mean, oh my God, your brain never gets a chance to wander. Right. It never gets a chance to ponder things or to just be. And those to me are the spaces where change actually occurs. You know, if we're trying, you know, I keep thinking we're dismantling all of these systems, right? But those systems live within our body energetically.
Right? Absolutely.
So you got to let that go too. I keep telling people right now, I'm like, do your scrubbing in the shower. Bathe, like sweat, like get it out. If we're going to be protesting in the streets, you got to get it out of your body too. We've got to move it through, let it move like clouds in the sky, because it wasn't ours in the first place.
Yep.
All that shit was not ours. So let it go. Like you don't have to invest in it. Let it go and let it move through. And I think rest and those things are those places. But I mean, I want to hear from you guys on that. But I don't.
Yeah. Oh no, but you talking some deep stuff. I mean, I tell the young folk all the time to say stay woke. I say you're gonna suffer from insomnia. You don't want to just stay woke all the time. You want to stay fortified. You stay fortified so you know when to rest. You know how to get your armor in place. You know how to recast yourself in order to be the kind of love warrior and spiritual soldier that you need, with love and justice at the center of it, and allowing the tears to flow and the laughter when the time is required for what? For empowerment of others through emptying yourself. Mm. That's the genius of Black folk. It's through kenosis, it's through the self-emptying that we empower others. But you can't empty yourself. One, you got to have a self. And two, you got to have enough courage that allow that self to be vulnerable enough so that people can find out who you really are in the first place. Take off your mask, quit posing and posturing, and be your real self. Mm. Well, see, that's what Diana, that's what Tracy, that's what Marvin, that's what James Brown, that's what Aretha, that's what Coltrane, that's what Mary Lou Williams, that's what we've been
doing
for 400 years. Richard Pryor, all those. Now, that doesn't mean we still won't get crushed by the police, because that's a structural and institutional thing, but we'll be bearing witness in such a way that people will have to take note of the love and the laughter and the joy, because can't nobody take your joy from you.
Nope.
Nobody can take your love from you and your precious memories of that love and that joy, no matter what. And then we move on, and then we embrace in others too, because when Beethoven ends up with the Ode to Joy in the Ninth Symphony, he's talking about the same joy. They got unbelievable repression. And it's a European thing. Well, they're human beings just like us, but it's expressed in a different way. Mm-hmm. It's got different style, got different form. But they're dealing with the same kinds of challenges and catastrophes. It just has different manifestations of mm-hmm. it.
Yeah.
And so when he invoked Schiller and that Ode to Joy and that ninth symphony of Beethoven,
yeah,
and he's deaf and he's still writing music, you say, oh, whoa, this is like Coltrane. This is like Aretha.
Yeah, it gives you that feeling.
Continuum. Exactly. But it's back to Sister Tracy's point about how you got to fortify yourself with the rest, trying to get the systems out of you by that white supremacy inside of Black folk. Try to get it out. Mm-hmm. Try to get that male supremacy out of the women. Trying to get the straight supremacy out of the gay brothers and lesbian sisters and trans and so forth. And then keep them in contact with that love. And that love is not something that we create. It's something that we have to relate. You got to get it in connection with others.
Mm.
You know what I mean? And that's what Sister Tracy takes us today.
Yep.
When you're taking us today.
I know. It's a beautiful thing. I pulled up the Audre Lorde quote, Tracy, so we can make sure it makes the episode for people. It's caring for myself is not self-indulgence. It is self-preservation. And that is an act of political warfare.
Audre.
She's always worth going back to.
She is
always worth going back to.
I mean, she don't never get it wrong. And she's as useful and valuable and fulfilled with the right way of, and she heard her own voice so loudly. Oh, and
one
so
of our great love warriors. Lord. I can remember standing beside her at the conferences that we used to go to. You could feel the vibration.
Yeah.
Like standing next to Mahalia Jackson or Gladys Knight. You know, you can just feel or standing next to Diana Ross. You can just feel that love just flowing, that overloving, that overjoying and overloving. You say, oh Lord, Audre, I just want to give you a hug. Well, give me a hug, brother. I said, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Wow. Trisha, what a treat you've given me. So honored to meet you and have this moment even virtually to sit with you, Dr. West. This is crazy.
Well, we're thrilled to have you. And, you know, I think our time flew right on by. So, you know, you are always welcome on the tightrope.
Absolutely.
You're one text away from being on the tightrope. So you just, you one text away. That's all I got. You just one text away.
Look, I'll just show you guys I've had this, is this called Breath of Grace? I've had this crystal in my lap the entire time.
Wow. That is beautiful.
Where'd you get that from, though, Sister Tracy?
I have a friend of mine that just, she seems to find, they just call her. And this one was calling me this morning. I wanted it with me all day today.
Beautiful.
That's beautiful.
That crystal came and got us and got Cornell going and came over to me and bounced back to you.
That's
so,
the truth. Well, you've given us great joy, wisdom, and love today. Not just us, but all who are listening and will be listening.
Yep, for sure. This was such a pleasure. You know, we're just so happy you were able to make time for us and, you know, really do come back and see us anytime. We just really heart to heart.
Well, you know how I feel about you, Trisha, and I just am in awe of your heart and your mind, Dr. West. Unbelievable. So thank you for having me. What a treat.
No, we thank you.
Love you. All right. Thanks.
Absolutely. Indeed.
And hang in there and, you know, show me where you got those crystals, okay? I'm gonna need me a crystal. I didn't think of that. This was very helpful.
Oh, that's one area you did not think of, Trisha.
I was like, dang it, I didn't think of no doggone crystals, but I'm gonna get me one now. All right, honey, it's great to see you.
Absolutely. Bye. Love you and respect you. Now. Definitely.
Wow, Cornell, that was an amazing conversation with Tracy Ellis Ross. She's just so, what a spirit, you know,
extraordinary human being, and the wonderful love flow between you all having known each other and then both of you all just being so kind to bring me in and embrace me like that. But she's got a spirit and intellect and a joy in her that just flows. It really does.
Yeah, I mean, just it reminds you how much we really need to take care of ourselves, rest, find ways to sort of let go and you know, we're holding so much in our bodies anyway, and then they just keep adding on to it. And you and she were like, look, just let it go. Like, let it pass. Let it, you know, duck back. It's like judo, you know, just, you know, let it just move right. Let it go. You know,
but it takes courage. It takes courage.
I mean,
she's a courageous person. She's not a coward.
No,
so she has the courage to be herself.
She sure does. And to still speak about things she doesn't have to speak about. You know,
that's exactly right.
Right, right. Well, exactly. I hope we can get her to come back, because I feel like we just scratched the surface, you know.
Definitely. Mm. Definitely. My God, my God.
All right, so we have a little bit of time left for our people to have an office hours. And you know, office hours for our tightrope listeners is our weekly segment. We try to take some topic and focus in on it. Sometimes you've suggested those topics, sometimes other people have, sometimes Doc West and I come up with it on our own. You never know. Today we have collectively decided we should talk about this question of millennials and their discontent with democracy. And apparently some new study shows that millennials are particularly concerned about democracy, about society, where we are now, and that they are particularly lacking in the assets of previous generations at this age. So wealth, inequality of wealth and income is very significant, and that millennials make up about 25% of the U.S. population, but they only have 3% of the wealth. Baby boomers, by contrast, had closer to 25% at this same point. So they're fearful about debt. They're fearful about not being able to take care of their families and unemployment and staying on their parents' couches forever. And so, you know, we wanted to talk a bit about what is the nature of this discontent, but also, I guess, Cornell, I want to ask you, you know, is it democracy they're discontented with? Is it, you know, corruption that's actually the source of that? You know, how should we think about this discontent and its relationship?
No, I think you raise an important question, though, because oftentimes the discontent has to do with something that's very positive. It's the corruption that you talked about. It's the greed. It's the lies. It's the downright crimes. It's the lack of accountability. It's the impunity that they're discontented about. That's a positive discontent.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You don't want people to be contented with lies and contented right. with corruption and so forth. Mm-hmm. But the disturbing factor is that if that discontent leads toward a full-fledged detachment and apathy, then there's no way of engaging that nightmarish reality
right.
and authorizing an alternative to it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so you end up being apathetic, and apathy, ironically, reproduces the same misery.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Reproduces the same oppression, the same domination, the same sense of helplessness, you see.
Right, right.
Does that make sense to you, though?
Yeah, 100%. Of course. It makes 100% sense. I mean, because it's not the discontent that's the problem. That's your point. It's like, you know, King's phrase, well adjusted to injustice, right? Right. You want to be maladjusted.
Maladjusted to injustice. Mm-hmm. But see, this is part of the problem with a lot of these social sciences who like to skate on the surface and not dig deeper beneath. Because they'll say, well, the young people are discontented. Something's wrong with them, as opposed to something wrong with the system that they're discontented mm-hmm. with.
You see? Right.
So they don't want
right.
to deal with the larger context and the way in which part of that discontent is a critique, if not an indictment, of the system in which they find themselves, the status quo that they're over against, and all of the various policies that put the burden on them, because the burden's on the most vulnerable. Who are the most vulnerable? Poor people, indigenous people, it's the women, it's Black folk, it's brown mm-hmm. folk, it's young people,
right.
and the elderly, and yep. working people, you see.
Yeah. So that basically everybody but a handful of elites who keep acting like the system works for everybody.
Yeah,
it sounds like you pretty much named
true.
Everybody, Professor West.
No, but we've got a strong upper middle class and a strong middle elite and higher elite.
Right.
We'll walk around with big smiles on their faces and break dancing to the bank.
Yep. Or just hiding out in the countryside. They don't want nobody to notice they're going to the bank.
That's true. That's
but so,
true.
But what's interesting too, if we think about these millennials in the context of, you know, the Obama era, right? Because they were more engaged, not significantly, but they were, there was a bump in their at least national political participation during the Obama years. And it was true that it did signal a kind of breath of fresh air and a generational change. And, you know, this, the narrative of hope was a very strong one. And the feeling that young people were more generally valued. Now, you know, I'm not here to make that case. I'm just saying that's what people perceived. And I'm wondering if that it's not the kind of fall, the sort of, you know, the hangover, as it were, the kind of white nationalist hangover and the economic hangover, which has gotten worse and worse, that that they're also responding to, right?
Right.
Which might be more specific to imagining that the system was as long as they got a Black president somehow, or a young sort of progressively sounding president, that that was going to change everything. I mean, so was it that they may have, just like the rest of us at that age, had kind of false expectations about what the democratic system in this country is really able to do?
Yeah, I think the desperation that the system produces cuts so deep that people are willing to have high expectations of persons who really appear as if they're different. And there's no doubt. I mean, Brother Barack Obama, he's a brilliant brother. He's a charismatic brother. He's an eloquent brother. So people thought, my God, we've got somebody who's not only different in style, but he might be actually very different in substance in terms of taking on Wall Street, taking on Pentagon, taking on mass incarceration, taking on new Jim Crow, taking on poverty and so forth. So it's understandable because the options are so limited within the confines of the status quo. And within the confines of the status quo, I mean, you know, Brother Barack Obama, you know, he got a lot going on.
It, the he problem was a breath became, of fresh air in that country.
Absolutely. That's why we supported him and so on, you know, twice. But we had to tell the truth too, because our allegiance is actually to something bigger than ourselves and Barack Obama, which has to do with the plight of poor and working people.
But I also think that the crises that were sort of extended with the financial sector before Obama, right, during Bush, it's kind of like, you know, the repercussions of a tidal wave, you know, are not really felt till quite a long bit later. And I think that's also part of the issue. It's like they're now realizing that insanity that was going on in the political system, you know, before they could vote or when they were just barely starting to vote in the early 2000s, you know, was the beginning of this crushing outcome that they're now dealing with 15, 18 years later.
No, I think it's true. I think it's true. But, you know, I also think the older generation, my generation, has to take some significant responsibility here because too many of those in my generation told the millennials lies and put forward illusions. Mm-hmm. We told the millennials to be human at the highest level is to be successful. Make sure you have your money, your status, you know, you go to the right school, hang out with the right crowd, live in the right neighborhood, and you will be happy. And the American dream will deliver something very, very rich and deep to you. And many of them discovered success is not the same as greatness. Success is not the same as happiness. Success is not the same as joy. Why were the older folk, who themselves sacrificed so much for us, telling us to be successful in this way? So even when we became successful, we still ended up oftentimes too empty. And when we weren't successful, they blamed it on us rather than on the system itself.
Yeah.
And so the millennials are looking around saying, well, wait a minute, people have been lying to us. God, Martin Luther King Jr. had a dream, and the dream is to be the highest person within the
be CEO.
Exactly, be CEO of whatever it is, some major company, or to be a professor at Harvard or Brown and so forth. And no. My precious parents told us, when you go to Yale, when you go to Brown, I want you to be a decent human being full of love and joy who spreads that to others. Yes. That's the life of Sister Tricia. Mom and Dad told me, little Cornell, when you go to Harvard and Princeton, don't get caught up in the success. Use the success for something greater, and he or she is greatest among you will be he or she who serves, who gives. who tries to do and speak in such a way that it uplifts other folks. What we saw with Sister Tracy.
Right.
Just a few minutes ago, you see. Yeah. And so not enough of the older folk did. Now, some did, of course. I'm not saying all. But the dominant orientation was be the smartest and the richest in the room.
Yep. That's and the most never connected.
Never been the message for the best of Black people.
No. But no, you know nobody. What else, Cornell? You know, to add mm-hmm. to your mm-hmm. fantastic analysis, because I really hadn't thought of it in terms of baby boomers, you know, betraying millennials in this way. Whether consciously or not, but there's two other things that I think, and I'm weird because I'm actually like, I'm on the last year of baby boomer, so I don't count. I don't want to be counted up in there. It makes me feel too old. I'm right on the cusp on my way out, but I'll say us just for political solidarity. Okay. So one of the other things our generation also didn't do, two things. One is that we haven't been vocal enough as a generation about how much our success and our financial stability is based on a set of public institutional investments and opportunities that were built for allowing people to survive the economic circumstances. So state schools that were well-funded and public schools that were better funded, not well-funded, but better funded.
Right.
And affirmative action programs that built the middle class for people of color.
Right.
And so on and so forth. And then all of the way unions, you know, the desecration of union work with stable wages and decent benefits, you know, all of those institutions, our generation were the beneficiaries of, we were the last beneficiaries of for the most
That's
part.
That's right.
And we don't say enough about it to say we're too busy saying we worked hard, just like the fools like to tell us all the time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Ooh, that's an important point.
You know, and so that's a terrible crime. I forgot my other point, but if it comes back to me, I will say it. But I know that has been a betrayal that, the other thing is that we think the civil rights era is the radical era and nobody else can be as radical as the civil rights.
Right.
So we're both doing better off benefiting from public institutions and then telling you y'all ain't radical enough, right? You can't ever be as radical as we were. This is what we marched. This is where we went. And so between that arrogance and all that wealth transfer that they're sitting on, or we're sitting on, if I'm join my actual generation, you know, it's, I think there'd be a lot of bitterness. So forget democracy. I think they're discontented with a whole lot more than just democracy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But then the irony is, again, is that when you ask the young brothers and sisters of all colors, what do you prefer, capitalism or socialism? They say socialism. You know, they don't mean the Soviet Union. They're not talking about Cuba. They're talking about some democratic distribution of resources, goods, and services such that we don't have the vast economic inequality and overwhelming.
Yeah, but we've had that with capitalism just fine for most of the 20th century. They're trying to turn what is a social safety net for human beings into an evil possibility, as if it didn't already exist.
You're absolutely right.
Boy,
but the young folk beginning to see through it. I mean, the good news
yes, that's true.
Is that so many young folk in college, out of college, on the block, on the barrio, on the reservation, even in the suburbs. You got a lot of vanilla brothers and sisters in the suburbs.
Yeah, a lot of loss.
They seeing through the lies and the illusions. They say, "Oh, mom and dad, we love you to death, but you were telling us too many lies and illusions. Well, we were trying to protect you. We just wanted to make sure you weren't overcome by just how bad things are." And we said, that's love takes a lot of different forms. Yes, that's true. But sooner or later, the truth is going to knock on your door.
Eggs, here it is. It's knocking right now.
It's knocking
hard. It's knocking like it did on Breonna Taylor's door in the middle of the night. A no-knock.
Lord have mercy. Lord have mercy.
That's how the truth is showing up right now.
And the police start lying, and the jury, and the brother, what's his name, Cameron and company, trying to hide the lies in order for their own.
Don't you remember the press conference he gave talking about, if we have, of course, we're happy to release this information if that's what the court requires. Now he's like, we ain't trying to release this information. How are we going to not release? You know, I'm like, you're singing a new tune, brother. You're singing a new tune. So I mean, I think as long as that discontent can be translated into action and imagination and a vision for another way to function, to fund our schools and our people and our drug rehab centers and our medical facilities the way we fund the Pentagon. As long as we can really help them transform that, we don't really need an entirely new system in so far as we can make significant gains by making those changes. And as long as they feel that sense of possibility, which I do think is in our hands, it is actually something we could do. Then that discontent could be our best friend if we're careful.
Oh, absolutely. You got to have noble discontent for any kind of breakthrough in life. You can't get out of the rut. You can't get out of routine. And you can't get out of structures of domination without some noble discontent. But it just can't be any discontent. You see, right. It's got to have a spiritual and moral dimension to it. So it takes you higher.
Right.
You know,
it's not called, I want a free COVID test for me. It's called, we need to provide rapid free testing for everybody at all times to stop this pandemic and to bring people's families back together. Not just, I want to get mine for me.
That's exactly right. Well, Donny Hathaway say he wanted someday we'll all, he didn't say someday I'll be free. Someday me and my partners will be free. Someday we'll all be free.
Yeah.
Part of the genius of the Black freedom.
Right, right. Imagine it, and eventually it's something that you're working toward. And so it helps you stay with it. Yeah, it's what you said last week.
Serve and sacrifice for. Yep. No, absolutely.
Well, we just want to tell the millennials to hold on and keep fighting. And, you know, I guess is in the words of Cornel West, keep yourself nobly discontented. And, and we can do something with that. You know, we can do something with that. All right. I think we got to let you go and we got to let our people go. At least, you know, the ones that are listening to the tightrope right about now. And thank everybody for joining us. Thanks for being part of our office hours and our show. And don't forget to subscribe and get notifications about content and new episodes as they come out, and watch us and share with your friends and let us know what you think. All right, everybody. Thanks for joining us on the tightrope. We'll see you next time.
Hey, Tightrope family, this is Jeremy Berry, co-executive producer of the Tightrope podcast. Dr. West, Professor Rose, and our team are excited to inform you about a special offer coming your way. On Tuesday, November 10th, the professors will be holding an exclusive live office hours segment of the Tightrope, and you can participate. Simply visit patreon.com/thetightropepod and join our new Patreon family, where we offer a more intimate connection to the professors through offerings such as the November 10th office hours. Both new and existing patrons are eligible to join, and you'll be able to submit questions and listen in on the dialogue between Dr. West and Professor Rose. A few patrons will even get to ask their questions directly and engage in a bit of dialogue with our esteemed host. Visit patreon.com/thetightropepod to join the family. We'll post details about the offer in the coming weeks. As always, stay strong and stay on the tightrope.